Okay. So, this is the third of my lectures on F-theory and elliptic vibrations. And last time, we reviewed the classification of Kodaira and Tate, who explained how to take a family of elliptic curves written in Weierstrass form. So here, F and G are sections of appropriate line bundles on some base manifold. So in particular, locally, F and G are functions on the base. And there's a very... There's an expression called delta, which is 4f cubed plus 27g squared, and there's a very kind of simple to check set of conditions which tell you, well, geometrically what they tell you, so here's my base manifold, and here's this delta equals zero locus, and the context of last time was that we were taking maybe it wasn't completely obvious, but we're taking transverse direction to that delta and some coordinate on that transverse direction, like t. And at t equals zero, we have a singular fiber. And at t non-zero, it's non-singular. And the type of singular fiber, and more precisely, the type of singularity of both, let's see, so this needs a, so the elliptic vibration over this is some x, and there's a map pi, both pi inverse of zero and also pi inverse of the transverse segment, the orange guy. These, or the transverse disk, I should say, both of these singularities were determined by the orders of vanishing of F, G, and delta at t equals zero. So I restrict F, G, and delta to my little transverse disk, and then I ask, now they're functions of one variable, local functions of one variable, and I ask what the order of zero is. And there's this famous table which specifies a Kodaira type and a singularity type of the total space of that of the elliptic family over that one parameter base, indexed by t. I can't remember if I called it t or z last time, but I'm calling it t today. So today we want to look at the following situation. So I could have my discriminant delta equals zero, and I could have my transverse family, and I could take a collection of transverse families, and it might be that the order of vanishing, so this collection is going to be parameterized by S. So I'm going to have a coordinate S which goes this way, as well as my coordinate T which goes this way. And it could happen that at S equals zero, the singularity is worse than the singularity at S not equal to zero. So the singularity I'm talking about is the T equals zero singularity. So I'm going to adjust my coordinates so that delta equals zero is locally given by T equals zero. And then I take this family of disks, and it might be that at certain values of the parameter along the divisor delta, I get a worse singularity. And so that's the phenomenon that I would like to analyze. And it gets analyzed by means of a really beautiful piece of mathematics, which is called simultaneous resolution of rational double points. So rational double points is a name for the ADE singularities. So AN, DN, E6, E7, E8 are called rational double points. There are lots of different ways of mathematically characterizing this class of singularities in two dimensions. In fact, there's a famous paper by Alan Durfee called 15 Characterizations of Rational Bubble Points. So there are 15 different starting points that you could use to classify, to characterize some list of singularities, and you end up with the same ADE series from each of those 15 starting points. The simultaneous resolution story was proposed by Grothendieck and worked out in detail by Breeskorn. And it explains how the deformation theory of these singularities is related to the resolutions. So why is that important for us? Well, our situation is that we have this family of elliptic curves in Weierstrass form, but the Weierstrass form has singularities, right? So the total space has singularities, and what I showed last time was how to resolve those singularities generically along components of delta. So by using this analysis of the transverse guy, you can then blow up the corresponding singularity and get one of these A, D, or E Dinkin diagrams. You're doing that simultaneously along the entire divisor delta, so you're getting families of resolutions of the ADE singularities. However, those families, as is apparent here, can have, at special values of S, you can have different things happen in those families. And from the physical point of view, that's what people identify with the matter representation of the gauge group or gauge algebra in question that we're reading off of the elliptic curves. So from the physical point of view, you sort of want to understand how those resolutions can change at special points, what the specializations of those resolutions can be. And this simultaneous resolution of rational double points theory gives a really beautiful way to analyze that problem. So I'm going to make an assumption, and I'll explain a little bit later why that assumption is reasonable. But my assumption is that along S equals 0, T arbitrary, we have a minimal Weierstrass model. So remember last time, there was a certain class of models that we called non-minimal. So either the order at t equals 0 of f restricted to s equals 0 is less than or equal to 5, or the order at t equals 0 of g restricted to s equals 0 is less than or equal to, is less than or equal to 3, or this is less than or equal to 5. So if the order was at least 4 and at least 6, then we were in this place in the Kodaira-Tate table of so-called non-minimal Weierstrass models. And from the point of view of the elliptic fibration over that segment, there was a change of coordinates that could be made. And that change of coordinates meant that you got a new elliptic family with a new line bundle. Now, if that happened to us at the generic point of delta, then we would actually be able to make that change of coordinates in a neighborhood of delta on the base, and we would find another elliptic fibration which we could continue with the analysis of. Here, I'm kind of supposing that the singularity is worse at s equals 0 than it was at other values of s, and so we probably don't have the non-minimal structure away from s equals 0. So we can't make that change of coordinates globally. Nevertheless, I want to stay away from those points. And I think I won't try to explain right now why we stay away from those points, but let me just say one word, which is that such points correspond to what are called extremal transitions.
These are the non-minimal points?
Non-minimal points. Non-minimal points correspond to extremal transitions and can be analyzed by blowing up the base. So I'm going to stay away from them for right now. I'm also implicitly, in this discussion, looking near a non-singular point of delta. So the discussion can be generalized to include cases where delta is not locally non-singular. For example, you could look at the intersection of two components of delta, or you could look at a point where delta acquires an irreducible singularity like a cusp. Just for the purposes of this first analysis, I'll also sort of stay away from points like that. I'm only going to look at places that are non-singular on delta where something different happens with the singularity. So in my local model, I've got my S and T space. I've got my coordinates S and T. Sorry, this was S, this was T. The way I've described it, and I have my delta, which is described by t equals 0 in these local coordinates. And I've gotten one of these rational double points at s equals 0. So at s equals 0, we have one of these rational double point singularities. And the question is, if you have a rational double point singularity at s equals 0, what deformations does it have? And in particular, we would like to know, when we blow up and resolve the singularity, how did the blow up change with the deformation structure?
So Dave, just to make sure I understand, so this is a codimension 2 statement about the rational double point. And you are...
Absolutely. So I'm actually just looking in codimension 2. I'm choosing coordinates which are somehow generic along delta at such a point. So
the assumption of rational double point is that things in codimension 2 are sufficiently nice so that you can do...
Rational double point follows from the Khadira classification. And so all I need is that my codimension 2 singularity is itself in codimension 2 minimal, right? It satisfies that either this is less than or equal to 3 or that's less than or equal to 5. That's enough to tell me that at s equals 0 I have a rational double point. Oh, and I guess I should say that the first statement here is that any deformation of a rational double point itself has only rational double points.
Okay. But so you're saying that given this condition up here, you're going to have ADE in codimension 2.
I'm going to have ADE in codimension 2.
Where does that fail when you go to codimension 3? This classic...
Have ADE in codimension. If I assume this,
okay.
I have ADE in codimension 3.
Okay, so that's the point that the Solyao picture doesn't have this assumption.
No. So the Solyao picture, even in codimension 2, there's something interesting that happens. So Solyao and Yao, this is codimension 2 on the base.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and that's codimension 3 in the total space. And so they're really talking about codimension 2 in the base. I'll explain their point in a couple of minutes. So the question is, what deformations does it have? There's a whole kind of theory of deformations of local singularities on surfaces, and we have to ask these questions up to holomorphic change of coordinates. Because if we don't ask the question up to holomorphic change of coordinates, we'll get infinite dimensional answers for our deformation theory. But there's a nice sort of answer up to holomorphic change of coordinates, and it says that, so my rational double point has some local equation, which I'm going to write in the form f of x, y, t equals 0. And there will be a finite number of terms in that of monomials in that local equation in appropriate local coordinates. And the deformations are just the f of x, y, t plus an appropriate collection of other monomials. Maybe I'll write vector x to the rats. Maybe I have to put... Let me just use a monomial form for the possible deformations. And typically I'm using lower order monomials than I had before. In fact, if this is a polynomial, then any deformation of the form f of xy t plus a partial with respect to any of the variables, x or y or t, of f times another polynomial, this is trivial after change of coordinates. So I can leave out terms that are divisible by the partial derivatives and thereby get a finite dimensional space of possible deformation terms that I would put in for these kinds of polynomials. So let me mention the examples. So in the case of an, that's x to the n plus 1, that's x squared plus y squared plus t to the n plus 1. And if I take the partials with respect to x, y, and t of this equation, I see that I'm not going to be allowed anything divisible by x or divisible by y or divisible by t to the n. So the natural deformation terms are just the monomials in t of lower order. So I have a2 t to the n minus 1 plus a3 t to the n minus 2 down to a n plus 1. So that's the basic deformation. And of course, I could add in other things that were multiples of these, but then by making a change of coordinates, I would learn that that was a trivial deformation. For the D case, so the form of the equation that I want to use for D, I want to make sure I follow the normalizations in my paper. Problem with using an online copy is it takes forever to page to the page you want. Okay. If I knew the number of the page, I would be in better shape. There we go. So here I actually wanted xy. I want x squared plus y squared z plus z to the n minus t plus t to the n minus 1. And then while I've got them here, I'll just say for e6, I'm going to want x squared plus y, x squared plus y cubed plus t to the fourth. For e7, it'll be x squared plus y cubed plus yt cubed. And for e8, it's x squared plus y cubed plus t to the fifth. So in each case, it's not so hard to now write down the corresponding deformation terms. And I'm not going to do it explicitly for these cases right at the moment, but in a minute we'll need them and we'll see what they are. So I implicitly described in the story that we told last time how to resolve the singularity for an. And the way you resolve the singularity for an is to blow up. And when you blow up, essentially you get something like, so now I'm not doing the deformation term, I'm just going to resolve x, y plus t to the n plus 1. When I blow up in an appropriate coordinate chart, I got x tilde, y tilde plus t tilde to the n minus 1. So I reduce the order of vanishing during the blowing up process. The first instance of this simultaneous resolution phenomenon comes when I look at this particular example. So I want to take a deformation of the A1 singularity, and the only thing I'm allowed to put in is a constant, but I'm going to take that constant to be a square. And just to make the algebra simpler, I'm going to put minus s squared as my constant. So that's a singularity of a threefold now. So since I'm working on a two-dimensional base for my elliptic vibration, I'm actually going to be studying some local patches where there are singularities of a threefold. That's the total space of the vibration. And by the way, the x cubed term in the Weierstrass model has sort of disappeared from this. It actually belongs to one of these trivial deformations of a rational double point, and so one should make a little change of coordinates to directly relate the Weierstrass story to the story I'm telling here, but I'm focused on the structure of the singularities. And this is one which has a familiar form to people who've looked at many singularities, namely, it factors as, or it's a sum of two factors, an xy factor and a product of two factors that are linear in T and S, and as such, there's a small resolution of this threefold singular point. So the small resolution is given by, actually there are two of them, by, you can blow up, say, x equal t plus s equals 0, and that has the effect of replacing what had been a singular threefold with a single singular point with a non-singular threefold in which the singular point is replaced by a p1. There's another resolution of the same singularity in which you replace it by a different p1. So each of these maps to the singularity. And then there's yet a third resolution which maps to each of these in which it's replaced by p1 cross p1. So when it's replaced by P1 cross P1, and you study what's happened to the family of surfaces, you find that the nearby non-singular surface goes to a surface that has two components. It's got the blown up A1 singularity, but that blown up A1 singularity is meeting this P1 cross P1 in the rational curve. On the other hand, if you're able to use either of these small resolutions, then you discover that you have a family of surfaces parameterized by S which are smooth at every point. And at S equals 0, you've resolved an A1 singularity, so you have a non-singular surface that contains the P1 that was the resolution. Nearby, for S non-zero, you have a deformation of that A1 singularity, which has no singularity whatsoever, and the rational map has done absolutely nothing to those singularities. So the first case, where we blew up to the P1 cross P1, that's a sort of typical thing, where a family of surfaces will degenerate to a multiple surface, several components having to meet each other. It's actually a delicate and unusual thing to be able to resolve that family of surfaces in such a way that it still fits together into a non-singular family. So that's the phenomenon known as simultaneous resolution of singularities. I had the singularity, I had the deformation of the singularity, and I was able to resolve all of the surfaces at the same time without introducing any extra components. And from the point of view of understanding the total space of the elliptic vibration, that was a fantastic thing to have happened, because I ended up with a non-singular threefold or fourfold or whatever dimension I'm in, threefold in the local model, a non-singular threefold, which resolved all those singularities simultaneously without introducing spurious extra components into the resolution process. So that was a great thing, and so we like this kind of simultaneous resolution, and that's what we're going to try to do to understand the structure of these special points along the discriminant locus in general.
So you said spurious extra components. What would such a component be? What do you mean?
Well, if I had blown up... So this is describing a threefold. If I had blown up the origin, I would actually have had two threefolds, one of them containing a P1 cross P1, and the other meeting the first one in that P1 cross P1. So I wouldn't have had this nice smooth family of surfaces just going to a surface. And because of that P1 cross P1 there, in fact, I would have disturbed the canonical bundle of the total space, and in particular I would have ended up with a threefold that resolved the singularities but no longer had trivial canonical bundles. So if I'm interested in Calabi-Yau's with trivial canonical bundle, then I need a condition like that.
So this guy right here is sort of an extra component meeting it in a funny way rather than completely resolving it but having a nice family that...
Well, if you like, I can do this in two steps, right? I can get to the P1 cross P1 case by first doing this and then blowing up this P1.
Right.
If I blow up this P1, I've taken a P1 on a Calabi-Yau threefold and blown it up, and that's destroyed the triviality of the canonical bundle by doing so. Mm-hmm. So that's the problem. I'm trying to do everything in a way that keeps the canonical bundle trivial.
The fact that it's simultaneous means you could have gone sort of in either way.
The fact that it's simultaneous means that the... I've got a map such that the inverse image of any point in the parameter space is exactly, the parameter curve, which is S, is exactly an irreducible surface, which resolves the previous singular surface. And if I went to the P1 cross P1 model, that wouldn't be true anymore. I would get, in my family of surfaces, I would have two components over S equals zero. So here's the theorem of Breeze-Korn and Grothendieck. Theorem says that first of all, the deformation space of ANDNEN is a neighborhood of the origin in CN modulo a finite group generated by reflections. So I'm going to call this R sub N. I'm just going to call this W of R sub N. And this is generated by reflections. So this business is, again, in some interesting sense, isomorphic to CN. So if I have a group generated by reflections, then typically the quotient of CN by that group is, again, a copy of CN. So it's a neighborhood of the origin in CN, and it's a CN sort of generated by reflections, and there's some associated group, which is called W. The second statement is... So if that's the deformation space, in particular, there should be some family, script X, over this guy. Yeah, so let me just write. Script X over CN mod W is the quote-unquote versal family. Should be called the universal family, but because of the problem I mentioned at the beginning where you have to allow arbitrary changes of coordinates, it's not universal. It doesn't have a uniqueness property, but it's like a universal family without a uniqueness property, and so people coined this word versal, which is universal without the uni. So there's some versal family over this space, and let's see, I'll leave my examples for a moment. That's a script X. If I form a family X tilde over X, which I get by undoing that quotient by a reflection group, so if I form this, then X script X tilde as a family over CN has simultaneous resolution. So let me explain it for A1, and then I'll explain it for AN, and then we'll see what it means in general. So for A1, the family looked like this. The way I've indexed things, xy plus t squared plus a2, where a2 in C mod W is the generator for that guy. Now, W is just Z2 in this case, and the way I do C to C mod W is to take a parameter here and send it to its square, except just to be consistent with the previous example, I'm going to call it minus S squared. So this construction of forming the X tilde means that I'm supposed to replace A2 by minus S squared, and that's the family which we saw had the simultaneous resolution. Right? That's the one which had the small blow-up, which had the nice property. So what's the generalization for AN? Generalization for AN is that I have an equation that looks like xy plus t to the n minus 1 plus a2 t to the n plus 1, a2 t to the n minus 1 down to a n plus 1. And a2 through a n plus 1 are going to be elementary symmetric functions in some parameters s1 up through sn plus 1 such that the sum of the si is equal to 0. So I'm going to take parameters s1 through sn plus 1, impose the condition that the sum of the si's is equal to 0. That's the first elementary symmetric function. Compute the rest of the elementary symmetric functions. And that's an action of w, which is sn plus 1, on cn. So cn modulo sn plus 1 was exactly the it was exactly the I don't want to say spec. I'm just going to drive everybody crazy. Has coordinates these elementary symmetric functions a2 through an plus 1. So what's the property that we get of this equation if we replace the coefficients by elementary symmetric functions in some other auxiliary coordinates? Well, that's hopefully well known. This guy is the same thing as xy plus the product of t plus si. I equals 0 to n plus, 1 to n plus 1. Right? Because the elementary symmetric functions in the SIs are exactly the coefficients in this polynomial, which is the product. Moreover, the sum of the SIs should have been the coefficient of t to the n, but that's the one that I set equal to 0 because of my derivative. So here I had a monic polynomial with a vanishing next to leading term, and if I can write that polynomial in fully factored form, then I get an equation like this. And now I can do a sequence of blow-ups of things like x equal t plus s1 equals 0, and then x equal t plus s2 equals 0, and so on. And in this way, you construct the simultaneous resolution pretty explicitly of this family of singularities. Okay, so I called the group W, and in fact, I have a group named W with the property that W of AN is SN plus 1, and anybody who knows Lie theory knows that my notation is incredibly suggestive. So the W in general of the RN is supposed to be the Weyl group of the associated root system. There are lots of interesting things you can say. One of them is that when you take Cn mod WRn and look for coordinates, so the coordinates here are the W invariant functions, those correspond to what are sometimes called Casimir operators. And so An corresponds to Sun plus 1, and as people may know, the Casimirs for that have degrees 2, 3, 4, all the way up to N plus 1. There are that many Casimirs. Those Casimirs correspond exactly to these coefficients. In the D and E cases, you can also write down explicit expressions for the deformations, which I'll do. I personally can never remember what the Casimirs are for E6, E7, and E8 unless I work out what the deformations of the corresponding singularities are. And it works very beautifully. So, for example, E6, 2, 3, 4, right? So if I want to know all the deformation terms, well, I need to the way we put weights on the corresponding coefficients is by using a weighted homogeneous degree for these monomials, which makes the whole thing be homogeneous. And if you're looking for such a degree in this case, you want the total degree to be 12. So that means that the degree of x should be 6, the degree of y should be 4, and the degree of t should be 3. And now when you took partial derivatives, you see that you're not allowed any x's, you're not allowed 2 y's, you're allowed at most 1 y, and you're not allowed 3 t's. So the monomials that are possible are 1t t squared, but not t cubed, and then yt and yt squared. And those have degrees 0, 3, 6, 4, 7, 10. And so to get to the degree 12, I have to give a complementary degree to the coefficients. So let me put them in. Here's my E6. X squared plus y cubed plus t to the fourth. And then I'm going to arrange them by degree. So it's A2YT squared plus A5YT plus A6T squared plus A8Y plus A9T plus A12. And 2, 5, 6, 8, 9, and 12 happen to be the degrees of the Casimir operators for E6. That's how you get them. So for the D, I should point out that the Weyl group of Dn has a reasonable property. That looks like a semi-direct product of Z2 to the n minus 1 semi-direct with Sn. And because the group is sort of well known, you can write down the invariance for the action in some quite reasonable way, and there's some very clever algebra that you do, which is the analog of this algebra for the AN case, which lets you see why the simultaneous resolution works in the DN case. So you make the appropriate base change from the coefficients back to this guy, and then you get some, it's not quite as simple as this factored form, but you get some very explicit way of seeing why the simultaneous resolution works. The E6, E7, and E8 cases are less direct in terms of being able to write down explicit formulas, but as I'll point out, to solve the problem that we're after, we actually need something about those explicit formulas, and there are various forms of those explicit formulas available in the literature, and in particular the paper that Katz and I wrote in the late 80s has, at least implicitly, the expressions for the A's in terms of elementary symmetric functions and some auxiliary variables that are analogous to the S's in this particular case. And you can use those to get your hands on certain kinds of computations.
Dave, is there an easy way to see why it's Z2 to the n minus 1? You might have said it, I just missed it.
No. Why that's the Weyl group for the orthogonal group? No, that's, I mean, And to say what it is for E67 and E8 explicitly, I don't really know an elementary way of saying that. So one of the mysteries about this was that the rational double points, although they had the same combinatorics as a Dinkin diagram, why in the world would you have expected the Weyl group of the associated algebra to have anything to do with the picture? And that's another part of the Breese-Korngrotendieck story, which I'm suppressing today, which is that there's a beautiful construction of the so if I look at the eigenvalue, if I look at the characteristic polynomial for the SUN case, I get a map from the group to the Cartan mod de Weyl group, which is exactly the space I'm looking at here. If I look at the inverse image of the origin of that map, I end up with a complex space that has singularities in complex codimension 2, and the complex codimension 2 singularity is the corresponding rational double point. So that gives an explanation in sort of Lie theoretic terms of why the constructions that you might make out of the Lie group and Lie algebra would have something to do with the structure of these singularities, because it's not just codimension 2, but at least the generic codimension 2 point is exactly that singularity. And that's actually how Breese-Korn gave a detailed proof of this correspondence. There's an argument to be made that the non-perturbative understanding of enhanced gate symmetry in type 2 theories and their cousins, which we arrived at in 95 after the second superstring revolution, gives a much more direct connection between these families of rational double points and the corresponding groups. So the corresponding gauge group is supposed to be the one associated to that rational double point, and here we're seeing sort of information about the gauge group showing up in the mathematical theory of the singularity. In particular, we'll come to that, but this there's some kind of Higgsing phenomenon going on, and the fact that that is the correct Coulomb branch of the theory is not an accident in this story. So
the parameters of the vets.
Pardon?
The parameters of the vets
in gauge theory terms. That's correct. So how am I going to apply this theory to the problem that I had, where I had basically some kind of degeneration of one kind of rational double point to another? So typically, along my discriminant locus delta, I had some kind of generic root system, Rn, and then I had a special root system at some particular value, which was maybe a different root system with a larger rank, typically in this picture. I should point out, So among other things, the action of these Weyl groups as groups of reflections are known explicitly in terms of the parameters that are used in the deformation. And that's all written out quite explicitly in my paper with Katz. And that's extremely useful because we are not interested for solving this problem in the general deformation. We're interested in a deformation which preserves a good amount of the singularity, but not all of it. For example, if k is equal to 1, then we're just dropping rank by 1. And so the issue becomes, for example, if you have an E6 as R prime 6, then how might you deform to get D5 or A5, which are possibilities for Rn, for R5, right? So one could ask, which family of deformations of E6 has general fiber D5 or A5 and special fiber E6? And once you've asked that question, well, in the A5 case, you're talking about Kadira type 1 sub I sub 6, which is A5, and then at a special point, you have this sort of E6 enhancement. Or if you're doing the D5 case, and that's Kadira type I1 star, and then again you have the E6 enhancement. So what we're looking for is a general way to analyze what's happening. Well, the cases that have been done completely explicitly are the cases where the rank only changes by one. So all those cases have been worked out completely. It's clear that if you are just expecting the rank to change by one, the number of deformation parameters in each of these cases is the rank. So if I'm looking for a family which keeps a singularity of rank 5, then I really only expect a single parameter to show up. That single parameter is going to somehow have to show up in this entire versal deformation space, but in this entire versal deformation space, which is a 6-dimensional space, there will be a 5-dimensional locus, which is, there will be a 1-dimensional locus where at the origin you keep E6, but there will be a 1-dimensional locus where, for example, you keep D5. And so that's universal for this problem. So that one is really completely defined by the condition that the rank only drops by 1. If the rank drops by 2, then you have a 2-parameter family within the versal deformation space, and at least in codimension 2, you're working with some kind of curve within that, and it could do a number of different things. It's not completely determined. But if the rank is just dropping by 1, it's completely determined by the conditions that I've mentioned so far. So the question, there are a number of questions, and among the questions are, you know, what happens when I resolve the D5? Do I need to make a base change to also resolve the E6? Suppose I make that base change, or suppose I don't make that base change, what sorts of things can possibly happen? So let me just describe in sort of general terms what can happen. And I'll do it by means of the simplest example, which is an plus 1 for r n plus 1 prime, and rn I'll take to be an. So I'm starting with an an plus 1 singularity, which has this form, and now I'm going to put in a deformation term, which will leave me with an an singularity, and the easiest way to put in that deformation term is to put in an s t to the n plus 1. Now, that technically violates the rules, right? Because I wasn't really supposed to have a subleading term. You could make a change of coordinates, complete the n plus second power, to turn that into the versal one, and then it's got lots of different powers of s with coefficients. This is just sort of the most efficient way of seeing what's going to happen in order to get the correct singularity type. So, and it should be clear that when s is non-zero, this t to the n plus 1 being a higher order term doesn't affect the singularity type. I really do have an an, whereas if s is equal to 0, this term isn't there, and now I have an an plus 1. So that it is that required deformation. So what happens when I do resolutions? Well, we kind of saw last time the typical thing that happens when you do the resolution, which is that the degree of these terms, so I'm trying to do the resolution in a way that's independent of S, right? So I only want to resolve sort of uniformly in X, Y, and T. That's how I'm going to do my simultaneous resolution, and I'll see what happens, and then maybe at the end I'll have to do something like that small blow-up of a conifold point, which produced that last resolution picture. So when I do this, I continually drop the degrees of these terms 2 at a time. That was the basic picture. So the next one is xy plus t to the n plus s t to the n minus 1, and I keep going down, and there are sort of 2 possibilities. One possibility is that I get down to xy plus t squared plus t plus s, or I might have gotten down to xy plus t squared plus st.
mean, this is the process of during the resolution introducing new coordinates and then replacing
That's correct. So that's correct. So when I did the resolution, I might have had an x as x twiddle times t and a y as y twiddle times t and a t. Maybe these should have been tildes, and this is tilde. Mm-hmm. And then when I put it into here, it drops the degree by two.
And I'm
avoiding the s, so I'm just keeping it constant in s for the moment. Yeah. Then I'm just suppressing the tildes because I have to tilde the thing n over two times, and I don't have notation for that. And so the endpoint depends on the parity, right? So if the thing had been, if n were odd, then I get down to here, and if n were even, I get down to here. So this case, I've actually completely resolved, right? I mean, I no longer have a singularity in the fiber. I've somehow, what the heck did I do? Let's see. The previous one would have been t cubed and s t squared. Yeah, t plus s. So I don't have any singularity left. It's not what I was really wanting to say was going to happen. This one, in the case of the other parity, I actually got, as a part of this resolution process, to the factored form with the conifold where I could do the simultaneous resolution. So in either case, I'm able to do the simultaneous resolution. I guess that's the moral of the story. Either because I got down to something that was non-singular automatically already, or I got down to something which became non-singular upon doing one final resolution of a conifold point. So although it wasn't obvious, there wasn't any additional change of parameters, like undoing a vowel group modding out, which was necessary in these cases. I should say that the so the Breeskorn-Grotnik theorem describes what happens for resolving the entire family. If you're resolving subfamilies, then you have to worry about how the Vah group acted on this subfamily, and was there anything fixed by that you had to do the base change for, and in this case there wasn't. So what's the geometric picture? The geometric picture is that I've got my AN general fiber, and as a special fiber, so it sort of comes along, all these components come along, but as a special fiber, either I ended up automatically getting as my final blow up, instead of a single curve, that single curve split into a pair of curves, or I ended up having a point that got resolved by one additional blow up. So in one parity, this central curve actually split up into a pair of curves right at this point. Or in the other parity, you had these two curves coming along, and then you had to resolve at this central point. So instead of two, you ended up with three curves right at that particular moment. So in either case, what you see is one more rational curve forming the fiber at the central point compared with the nearby points. And now, interpreting things in terms of in group theoretic terms for analyzing the F-theory model, it's pretty clear how to do that. So there's a very nice dictionary in which you associate to the roots of the Lie algebra, the simple roots of the Lie algebra, the components that are swept out by these rational curves, and you measure charges of various rational curves by their intersection numbers with these components. And when you go through that process, you discover that this collection of rational curves forms a fundamental representation of the n plus one dimensional representation of SUn plus the SUn plus one, which is the gauge algebra associated with this generic fiber An. So the number of components is n, simple roots of n of SUn plus one, and then measuring the charges by looking at the intersection numbers, you discover a representation, the fundamental representation of SUn plus one associated to that special fiber.
So those curves intersect the curves associated with the roots to give the Dinkin labels of that rep?
Exactly.
And so those are going to be good. So in toric language, that's like the labels in the Mori cone or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
And the reason you only have so many curves of that type is to give the fundamental is because you just don't have any more singularity to resolve? Is that?
Well, I got a fundamental at that particular point, right? Now, what I've done is I've resolved the singularities of the total space by this process, and what I got was the same curves as before, but one extra curve. Either one extra curve by closely analyzing this or by doing an extra blow up here.
Good. So to have the point being to have the fundamental, you need n plus one curves instead of n.
You need n plus one curves instead of n. Exactly.
So the thing that sort of tells you to stop adding roots when you're doing the representation theory is the fact that you don't get more curves than that, period. Just.
Well, the remarkable thing, so. So there's a there's another way of attempting to analyze what the matter content of this thing is. So let me remind people familiar with the physics what's going on here. I have my Calabi-Yau manifold of some dimension, 3 or bigger, and I'm looking at M theory on that Calabi-Yau manifold. And if I look at the resolved Calabi-Yau manifold, I'm going to have been generating a whole bunch of massive states whose masses are proportional to essentially the areas of these various rational curves. And they're all going to shrink down to zero area to become massless states in the F theory limit. So I have to have some kind of control over these rational curves that are currently massive and are becoming massless in the transition. There's a beautiful argument in M theory which says that if you take a rational curve and try to, this is an argument of Witten's, and try to quantize the physical theory you get by wrapping the M2 brain around the curve, that you get an answer that depends on the deformation space of that curve. If the deformation space is one-dimensional, you end up with a vector as well as a half-hyper in the spectrum, whereas if the deformation space is zero-dimensional, you only get a half-hyper. And because you can wrap the M2 brain with two different orientations, those two things together make up a hypermultiplet. So we're going to get hypermultiplets from these two rational curves because they can't be moved, even though the other ones can be. But you can extend the argument and argue that when you have a connected rational curve of appropriate numerical properties, that the same argument should apply. And the connected rational curves here will be this one plus the next guy, this one plus the next guy plus the next guy, this one plus the next guy plus the next guy plus the next guy, and also in the other direction. And if you count all those things plus their complex conjugates, you get exactly the set of roots in the fundamental representation.
So the adding the connected guys is like subtracting something.
Right. So to get the, by the way, if the family of singularities has genus bigger than zero, you're actually expecting to get some non-trivial adjoint representation in the picture, and you get those again the adjoints by not just simple roots, but not just positive, not just simple roots, but simple roots plus appropriate combinations, which still give rational curves, that gives all the positive roots, plus the complex conjugates, that gives all the negative roots, that gives the total charge matter content of the adjoint that you're looking for. And there's some neutral stuff, which has a different explanation in F theory. So here, I'm also getting the total charge matter content of the given representation.
And which paper witnesses that you were mentioning?
It's called, I always call it M and F theory, because those are in the title.
M theory and F theory.
Yeah.
And And one more silly question. Can you remind me what a half hyper is? I would call that a chiral, using stupid.
Well, chiral isn't quite.
Chiral representations don't exist in
it's the wrong amount of supersymmetry for chiral. A hypermultiplet is supposed to come in a quaternionic representation of the group. If you have a quaternionic representation, what is a quaternionic representation of a group? Well, if you have I have to say this carefully or I'll get it wrong. Roughly speaking, if you have a quaternionic representation, then it should look like a complex representation plus its complex conjugate. So that's one way of getting a quaternionic representation, is to take a complex representation and the complex conjugate representation. There are other representations which are fundamentally quaternionic, which you can't do this to. If you try to label representations according to the complex representation rather than the quaternionic, this is behaving like half of this representation, and that gets called a half hyper. And in fact, to get the complex representation, you have to take this guy and all of its connected guys, and then for the other one with its connected guys, those you have to take complex conjugate. So these complex conjugates paired with these unconjugated ones and vice versa to get the representation theory to work out right. So this is the simplest case, fundamental of SUN plus 1. It doesn't have a lot of complications in the sort of mathematics of what's happening with resolving the singularities or in the interpretation that you give in the matter representation of F theory. But there are cases in which there is some in which this vial group action or the remnant of this vial group action is important. And the simplest one of those has Rn plus 1 prime is Dn plus 1, whereas Rn is An. So, by the way, for large enough n, the only cases that you would get of enhancement that could occur in this way would be to go up to an plus 1 or to go up to dn plus 1. For some low values of a, you could also get e6, e7, and e8 as these rank 1 enhancements. But once you get past a8, once you get to a9, you have no hope of such an enhancement. If you try to do enhancements that are analogous to the E enhancements in those cases, you'll end up with these codimension 2 non-minimal points, which, as I said before, are best analyzed by blowing up the base, because they're really the transition point of some extremal transition. So this is sort of the first case, and unfortunately I don't have at my fingertips, plus I'm running out of time, the local equation for this, but let me just tell you what happens. So what happens in this case is the Dn plus 1 diagram has, so this is Dn plus 1. So it's got two curves here, and then it's got n minus 1 curves here. And the AN diagram
it's N minus 1 plus 2 because it's the affine diagram?
It's DN plus 1. Oh, it's N plus 1 curves, right? So the AN diagram has N curves. And the AN diagram with N curves has the possibility of a symmetry. And the case that I'm interested in, I've got to get the parity right. I'm sorry, I didn't really prepare this properly. So if I have a symmetry which has a single fixed curve in the middle, then there have to be two fixed points on that fixed curve. And it's the resolution of those two points that are going to give me the two curves in the Dn plus 1. So So what ends up happening in this case is one of two things. Either the action of this Z2 is trivial, and then those two fixed points that I just mentioned are conifold points, and we could do the simultaneous resolution. So that would be a case in which you just had this family of n curves coming along, and then somehow they sprout two other curves in the middle. Yeah, it looks like it's in the wrong place. And so maybe what you have to do is, it looks like it's in the wrong place. Maybe you have to do some flops to see why it's the right thing for dn plus 1. I'm not quite remembering that at the moment. The Z2 action is non-trivial, and then simultaneous resolution is not possible. And in that case, because of this action, what you're going to find at the central point is that certain curves got identified with each other at that particular point. And because of the curves getting identified with each other, you discover that you no longer have the SUN plus one monodromy, gauge symmetry, but you've got, as I described last time, this Tate phenomenon of getting a smaller group, a symplectic group, describing the story here. So in the first case, you can easily analyze the representation content of this guy, and you discover an anti-symmetric representation as being associated to this thing. In this case, you have to do a different kind of analysis, again, based on Witten's argument and the fact that some of the curves are parameterized by one particular curve, other ones are parameterized by a double cover of that curve, tells you that you need to look at the action of this Z2 on the Lie algebra of SUN plus 1. And when you do that, you discover that there is a contribution from the Lie algebra of the symplectic guy and another contribution from the sort of anti-symmetric part of that action, which again gives an anti-symmetric representation in some appropriate sense. So in both cases, I get an anti-symmetric representation, although it has to be said that it's of different algebras, because in one case it's of the symplectic algebra, and in the other case it's of the unitary algebra itself. So this phenomenon that although I sort of labeled the degenerate fiber by a dn plus 1, I might not have been able to do the simultaneous resolution, and I might not have actually gotten a dn plus 1 fiber over that point. That's the phenomenon that Assoli and Yao pointed out about a year and a half ago. They pointed out that there are a number of interesting cases where, even though it's been traditional to label the matter content as if it came from a Dynkin diagram, in fact, the simultaneous resolution fails, and it's not directly obtained from that Dynkin diagram as a diagram of what happens over that point. On the other hand, it's always a quotient in some appropriate sense. And so those guys worked out this example and a number of other interesting examples, ones which show up in these SU5 theories, and got a lot of detail about the relation between which curves show up in the resolution and the corresponding, I think they were de-emphasizing the point I've been making, which is that that there is some, if not Kadaira fiber, there's at least some associated root system, which is the limiting root system as you go to that point. Anyway, there are a lot of other interesting phenomena, but I think I've probably tried your patience enough for today. Maybe I will stop here and take more questions. Yes?
So I like this setup because there's a nice, if you think of a 2B limit of this case.
Right.
You've got some D7 grains and they're intersecting an orient folded.
Exactly.
I would expect both anti-symmetrics and symmetric tensor representations.
Right.
Why is there not a symmetric here?
Okay, so getting a symmetric tensor is possible but trickier and actually requires a collision between two different components of delta, one can sort of conclude after some thought. And because I started with a setup in which I had only one component of delta, I'm not getting symmetric representations from this construction. The actual representation content, I'll just repeat what the argument was. All the representation theory actually, in this case, comes from rational curves which move in families. So there aren't any new rational curves showing up at the singular limit like there were here, which you could use to analyze the representation theory. However, what is happening is that some of the rational curves moving in families move along one curve, and other ones move along a double cover of that curve. And so some of the roots in the root system are associated to the double cover, and some of them are associated to the original, and that gives you an excess of a certain number of representations, a certain representation content having to do with the difference in genus between these two guys, corresponding to the other representation, and there's a way of associating them to branch points, which are the points that we just looked at.
And this is in the symmetric case.
No. This is the case I just analyzed. This is this anti-symmetric case. And the reason it has to be anti-symmetric is that you just analyze how that involution has to act on the root system, and anti-symmetric is the answer for the representation theory. So to do symmetrics, you have to work harder. But symmetrics correspond, this was something observed by Sadov a long time ago, symmetrics correspond to places where two components of the discriminant meet, or actually it can actually be a self-intersection. Doesn't really have to be globally two different components.
Why do you quote a Sadov paper about symmetrics? Is that the one?
That's the one, yeah.
Okay. 97 or something.
That's right. Yeah, Sadov is one of six authors of the first paper to try to systematically analyze matter, which was Bershadsky et al., as it's called by some. Bershadsky and Trilligator, Katru, me, Vafa, and Sadov. That's six people. Good. But then Sadov made these observations about symmetrics right at the end of the project, and there wasn't time to put it in, so he just wrote a little paper afterwards.
Is there a simple way to see, just from type 2D intuition, I would put the symmetrics and anti-symmetrics on the same footing. There's just different brain intersections, and in the 2A picture, it's just a question of whether you add or subtract the homology cycles, and it's pretty, they're on equal footing, but here it seems they're different. Is there an easy way to see why?
No.
Okay, that's fine. All right,
I'll quit for today. And resume sometime in January.